We're back with the good doctor. Dr. Aaron Carroll joins us most Wednesdays during this hour to talk about health care, health insurance, health policy, your health. Last week he was here for Sex Week with his co-author for his latest book, Don't Put That In There, and 69 Other Sex Myths Debunked. Rachel Vreeman joined us as well. And you should read their other books. Get their other books. Don't Swallow Your Gum and Don't Cross Your Eyes. He is a world-class blogger as well. The Incidental Economist is his blog. And he is a contributor to the New York Times at The Upshot. What's your latest article at The Upshot, Dr. Carroll? And don't forget about his videos at Healthcare Triage on YouTube.
I think it was last week. It was on the salt, the low salt versus the high salt diet.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just...
We talked about that, didn't we?
No.
We never talked about the salt thing. We had to have.
I don't think so.
Oh.
Because you weren't on when I was on vacation, and then last week we did Sex Week, and if we did, I wouldn't. It must have been 4 weeks ago. And it wouldn't have been then. So
make sure.
Even if we did, remind me, because you know how I forget.
So for I don't even know how many decades, everyone's been telling us, you know, we eat too much salt. We eat too much salt. You know, salt is going to kill us. And there are plenty of observational studies and plenty of studies which show that, you know, high salt diets are correlated with high blood pressure, and that all of that is correlated with bad, you know, cardiovascular outcomes, more heart failure, more heart attacks, more strokes, more death. High salt diet, really bad. So this was, and so for years, you know, everyone's been recommending that we lower the salt in our diet. And so, you know, it's like the, I think the FDA says we should be at like 2.3 grams of sodium per day, and the WHO says like 2, and of course the American Heart Association always weighs in at like 1.5 grams of sodium per day, which is like an insanely low amount of sodium. And for a long time people have said, there's no, you know, we're not going to argue with you, high salt diets do appear to be bad, but there's not a lot of evidence that these super low salt diets are good. But as we do with everything sort of in America and often in the world, we say, well, if something is bad for you, we have to 100% get rid of it. We should have none of it. We go to extremes. We have no concept of moderation. And so this study, which is published in the New England Journal of Medicine now maybe like 2 weeks ago, was huge. You know, 100 and some thousand participants in like 19 or 20 countries, and they followed people looking at their sodium intake and then whether or not they had, you know, high blood pressure or cardiovascular outcomes. And as you would expect, you know, compared to people that eat 3 to 6 grams of sodium per day, people that eat more than 7 grams of sodium a day had higher blood pressure and they had higher risks of cardiovascular death. They had more strokes, they had more death, they had more bad outcomes. But, and of course the news ran with this as they always do, and they said, you know, eat less salt. But what wasn't as publicized, what I'm losing my mind about, is that they also looked at a low salt diet. And people that ate less than 3 grams of sodium a day had higher rates of death than the people who ate more than 7 grams a day. And the people who ate less than 3 grams of sodium per day had higher rates of bad cardiovascular outcomes or cardiovascular events than the people who ate high levels of salt. In essence, they were saying less than 3 grams of sodium a day was actually worse for you than the high, or associated with more worse outcomes than the high salt diet.
Wow.
And before anyone sort of says, well, it's a skewed group, they did the sub-analysis of people who were, had no risk factors. In other words, the healthy people. So, you know, some people say, well, maybe the really sick people were the ones trying to eat the low salt diet and they just have bad outcomes. And they said, fine, we thought of that. We did a sub-analysis of only people who were healthy, who had no risk factors. It was like 58,000 people. And they found that for them, they had an even higher risk of death and an even higher risk of a bad adverse event if they ate the low-salt diet. And the low-salt diet was defined as less than 3 grams per day. The average American in the United States eats 3.4 grams of sodium a day. So everyone who's going to start screaming that it's impossible to eat a low-salt or a normal-salt diet in the United States, the average person in the United States is on the low end of what we would consider normal of 3 to 6 in this study. So we're not eating too much salt. We're not, like, it's not all this processed food, which is full of sodium, and it's impossible to get away from it. There's no evidence to continue to advise people to be eating the 1.5 grams that the American Heart Association says, or even the 2.3 that the FDA says. And for everyone who sort of, you know, keeps telling us everyone has to eat less salt, there's a fairly, you know, growing body of evidence that we need sodium in our diet, and that, you know, going this far, trying to eat nothing is bad for us. That you don't want to eat too much. No one is advocating you should go out there and eat more salt or you should eat more sodium. But, you know, this showed that less than three was just as bad, if not worse, than more than seven. That we need to learn about moderation. We need to learn about finding just the, what is the sweet spot. Don't eat too much. Don't eat too little. But sort of our obsessive need to keep driving every bad thing 100% out of our lives is not always a good idea.
So before my wife loses her mind, salt is natural, although we don't talk too much about salt.
Well, sodium, remember, it's all sodium. Salt is just where we get a ton of our sodium.
Sodium isn't the element, salt isn't the sodium. Periodic chart Na?
Yeah, well, Na, yeah, it's NaCl.
Yeah, that's all sodium. I remember. In chemistry in my junior year, yep. I was like, oh, this is going to be, I'm gonna kick ass, because the first week I just got nothing but perfect scores. Nice. But it was memorizing and recognizing the periodic chart.
I was actually a chemistry major in college.
Were you really?
Yes, I was.
Wait, Melanie, what are you saying? It's not Na? Isn't sodium Na?
Natrium.
Nah, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Oh, my God.
Oh, she's just saying Na. It's not funny if it's not, though.
NaCl.
No, she's driving me nuts. All right, so... Sodium, less than three, more than seven. It is somewhere in the sweet spot is best.
Had a higher risk of bad outcomes and death than greater than seven.
Even using a subset of healthy people already.
Even when you look only at healthy people, in other words, so they said let's strip out all the people who might have been sick and therefore striving for a low-salt diet but still died. They said let's only look at the people who don't have cardiovascular risk factors, who don't have diabetes, who don't have known, you know, cardiovascular outcomes in the past. Let's look only at them, and they had an even high, it's table two for those of you who are interested, they had an even higher risk of death or bad outcomes. That was the highest sort of subgroup of all. In other words, healthy people striving to eat incredibly low levels of salt or sodium had the worst outcomes.
The bottom line is sodium is natural, and we need a certain amount of it.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Okay,
yes.
And then let me ask you this, if you know this. Where is in the American diet do we generally get our sodium? Because I feel like, and tell me if I'm wrong here, I feel like sugar is a little bit more obvious than salt in terms of, you know, adding it on a regular basis to things like our coffee or other things. But I guess we shake salt on plenty of things, but I think more about what is salt already in, what is sugar already in that we might not realize.
It's in sodium, granted. Sodium is in almost everything. I mean, if you go look in the, you know, the side of a box of anything, you're going to see sodium is in there. You know, there are levels of sodium. The problem is that we've gotten so obsessed with it, we're trying to eliminate it to zero. You know, I had a colonoscopy. This actually was right after I had a colonoscopy a couple of weeks ago, and I was, you know, eating clear the day of, and so I was drinking broth only at work. And because this was right before the study came out, I bought this, like, organic low-sodium broth from the market. It had, like, almost no sodium in it, and it tasted like death. And I think I even tweeted during the day, like, this is the worst thing I've ever tasted. And then, because I was like, I don't want all that sodium. That sodium's going to be so bad for me. I don't want it. And then when the study came out 2 days later, I was losing my mind that I'd forced myself to eat this. That there was no need for this. Because, like, there's just, you know, the idea that, and again, this is what it comes from. It's like everyone just assumes we're all eating too much sodium. We're all eating too much salt, ignoring the fact that the average level in the United States is 3.4, and since there's much less room between 3.4 and 0 or 1.5, that means probably even more people are eating a low or no sodium diet, and because there's got to be some outliers, so we're eating way too much sodium. Of course there are. So probably the vast majority of Americans are eating on the low end of what would be considered a normal range of sodium in their diets, and that's eating the bad diets that everybody already thinks we all are in the United States anyway.
I wanted to ask you something. Well, before I move on from the salt thing, is there anything that, you know, to answer my earlier question, I don't think you really answered
it
in terms of
our... What is it in? It's in everything. I mean, it's like it's almost in everything. I mean, sodium is just in...
Is there a place where we get it and we don't...
Well, I mean, like soy sauce is like, oh, my God. You know, it's like soy... You know, 1.5 grams of sodium a day is like 1.5 tablespoons of soy sauce. Soy sauce is like entirely sodium.
What do you think of this? We went out for sushi the other night. I was going to take a picture of it because I know you're a huge fan. But we went to the girls wanted hibachi. We love going to hibachi.
Yes, my kids do.
So it, and it's fun. All kids love it. So we walk in. I mentioned this yesterday on the air, but we walk in and the place is empty. It was like 5 o'clock on a Saturday night. At, you know, dinner had started. And the guy says, "Oh, you're lucky. We have a table just open." And I was like, table just open. The whole place is empty. So he brings us over, and there's these two couples in their 60s, and he tries to sit us down with them.
Yep.
And I'm like, all due respect, folks, we're celebrating our anniversary. We would like a little privacy. So if you can't put us at another table, I understand, but we'll just have sushi. And, some people were outraged and said that hibachi's always community. But was I wrong to want to sit alone with my family?
Well, I think that they are community, and it's probably what they're trying to do is you have to remember it's like the number of chefs.
No, I get it. I wasn't mad at anybody.
Do, but you're a customer. You're allowed to ask for whatever you want, and then they can decide if they want to meet your request or not. I don't think it makes you a monster.
They were so relieved, these two older couples. They didn't have to sit with my kids,
yeah.
You know?
Well, plus, they might be out for their Saturday night. I don't think that's horrible. Now, on the other hand, if they explain...
What would you have done?
It depends, like, what night of the week it was and if anything else. Probably, I don't know. I think, honestly, I would have just deferred to Amy, whatever she wanted.
Well, good for you.
You know me, I would rather not eat with the, you know, people I don't know ever. So, but, you know...
Well,
Amy,
I bring it up. I bring it up because I saw this piece that you're talking about and referencing. I don't know where I saw it, but I just went to the Incidental Economist, Dr. Carroll's blog. And if you're not following him on Twitter, you're missing out. At Aaron E. Carroll, 2 R's, 2 L's. Give him a follow. Such a great resource for information that's important to you and your family. Family dinners are important is the title of your blog. This is a weird study to be doing. Explain how this works, because I was – really, really almost got sentimental about this because I changed my lifestyle so I could be home with my family and have dinner with them more because I got the advice from so many dads of older kids. So many guys, when I ask them, what's the best advice you can give me as a parent? They often said, you know, spend time with, specifically have a meal, dinner, if you can, with your family. And now there's a study about it?
Well, there's studies pop up all the time. It's sort of interesting, but it's one of those where I joke all the time. There was a great, even before I get to that, there was a great article in the BMJ many years ago, back on the kick of evidence-based medicine when people were like, if you don't have a randomized controlled trial, then you shouldn't believe anything. And this guy wrote this article about how, nobody had ever proven that parachutes work by randomized controlled trial. Therefore, it was ridiculous that we relied on them for jumping out of airplanes, because until somebody did the randomized controlled trial, we had no evidence that they were superior to placebo. And it's a joke, but it's, you know, why would you do it? And in the same way, family dinners are sort of like, you know, well, of course they're good. But anyway, there are studies, and people do them. So this study was looking at – it was actually a larger study about cyberbullying. It was trying to look at, adolescents and see how often does cyberbullying occur, and is it linked to mental health problems like substance abuse or anxiety or depression or anything like that. And it's a no-brainer. It shouldn't surprise anyone that, of course, you know, kids that are more likely to be cyberbullied are more likely to suffer from mental health problems. They have a nice little chart which shows, you know, if whether you're never, often, rarely, or, you know, all the time cyberbullied, how many sort of mental health issues do you have? But they also did a little analysis where they said, how many times a week do you have family dinner, like dinner with all of you getting together? And what they found was that there was a nice relationship between having family dinners and the number of them and whether or not cyberbullying actually had an effect on mental health problems, that the more often you had dinner as a family, sort of, you know, going from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then it sort of levels out, that by the time you get up to 4, the family dinner sort of blunts the effect of the cyberbullying. And it's not a randomized controlled trial, so there's no causality. But you can imagine that it's like, oh, what happened today? Someone was, you know, regular contact with family, you know, and the ability to talk about these issues and the ability to sort of, you know, have some sort of backstop or discussion seems to blunt the negative effect. And again, it's like, this should be a no-brainer. It's like, yeah, you know, if you have a good relationship with your kids, it's likely you can help them overcome the adversity with what they are, you know, facing on a day-to-day basis. And of course, I would always be like, what's the harm? You know, this is one of those, there's no downside to this. Of course you should do it. And it just builds on the past data. I think that was like, maybe the spring, but some time ago there was a study which tried to do a family intervention, and part of the family intervention was family meals, and that actually seemed to decrease obesity. And that was a randomized controlled trial. And I wrote an editorial, it was in JAMA Pediatrics, I actually wrote an editorial in the journal at the time saying, you know, it's great that this seems to have short-term effects for obesity, and, you know, hopefully they'll be long-term, but it's like, who cares? It's like, you know, family dinners just seem to be such a, one of those silver bullets that just sort of do so much good for kids in so many different ways that just do it. You know, everything, so, to be weighing the benefits versus the harms. There's massive benefits, it appears, and no harms whatsoever that I can figure out. It's a great idea.
Well, fight can always happen. We used to have arguments.
Happen because of family dinner? Like your relationship got better because you avoided family dinner? I mean, it's, you know, that it's hard
but
to
you're, but there in any of these studies, there's no causality. You're admitting
well,
that.
Well, there was in the obesity one. That was a randomized controlled trial.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was like they did an intervention with a randomized controlled trial, and part of that was encouraging family meals. So that is causality. So I'm thinking they've actually done studies even with randomized controlled trials and trying to encourage. Now, of course, they can't put a gun to your head and make you do the family meal. All they can do is, you know, do an intervention where they significantly, you know, encourage you to do family meals. And in those studies, people often do more family meals, and that results in a good effect.
And you can imagine that one would be because a family meal is generally something that you cook at home, which
right,
means it's generally
right. I mean,
healthier
again,
than.
Again, there's just. There have been. This one was not a randomized controlled trial, but there have been randomized controlled
but
trials.
But the bottom line is having a meal with your family, it's usually dinner, but having dinner with your family is so important for so many reasons.
Yeah.
And we're talking obesity, combating bullying, and nutrition and socialization and
right.
you
Good
name it. It's
with your kids, open dialogue. I mean, it's like I'm a pediatrician, granted, so I drank the Kool-Aid on this one. But it's like, you know, we do so many things and we talk about so many things on even on your show where I'm like, well, you know, weigh the harms, weigh the benefits. This has got this harm, this has got that. This is one of those like, what? You have to make up a crazy harm, you know, or a joke
right.
to try to find the downside.
Fork stabbings are up.
Yeah, I mean, it's like. This is a no-brainer. If you can pull this, and granted, I know some people it's just impossible because of work or style, whatever it is. But any time you can find a way to squeeze, you know, make meals with your kids, you know, happen, it's a good thing all around.
I want to talk to you about Ebola in a second. I got a question about a marijuana study that I want to ask you. But before we get to that, and if anybody else has any questions about any health study or any argument they want to have settled, or health insurance or health care, it's always a great time to call 866-994-6343. The best time, Dr. Aaron Carroll's at our service here. CVS dumps tobacco a month early. We talked about this when it was announced.
Yep.
They're changing their name to CVS Health. Maybe this is a question for a business, a corporate, a branding expert. But in terms of health policy, you've talked a lot about everything from cigarette bans and restrictions and taxes to the Bloomberg proposal of the ban on the giant sodas, which you didn't agree with. But on this issue, here is a story: the nation's second largest pharmacy chain has kicked its tobacco selling habit a month early ahead of schedule, removing cigarettes and other tobacco products at all 7,700 CVS stores. What does it mean for health? Anything?
Well, I think it's, you know, first of all, probably yes. You know, anytime you make it harder for people to get tobacco, it's possible or likely it's going to have. I mean, certainly in the past it's had a good health outcome. We talked about this again when they sort of announced it, and at the time I think my stance was like, I think it's great. But I imagine, because I'm cynical, in some back room they did the calculations and figured out that the PR was going to outweigh the sales, or the PR that this would bring them would bring customers in such a way that would overcome whatever losses they might see, or perhaps they weren't selling as much as they... But you know what? Who cares? Who cares? You know, I'm ascribing motive at this point, and it just doesn't matter. It's likely that this will result in even, you know, fewer people trying to smoke cigarettes, use tobacco. We know that there are monstrous negative health outcomes for them. They are still able to get them in many other locations. It's getting harder and harder to smoke them, but that's the whole other story. So yes, I mean, you know, it's hard for, I think you'd be hard pressed to find any public official or physician who doesn't think that this is a definitely, you know, a good move in terms of the public's health. But I don't, you know, necessarily know that it's 100% charitable or because CVS has now decided that they only care about health, because if they did, there's tons of other things in the store which are still dangerous or still, you know, not good for you. And I don't think they should have to get rid of those things either. I just don't attack them every day for those things, nor do I, like, praise them for other decisions that they make.
CVS Health, they also, though, have 900 walk-in clinics at CVS stores. Those, you like those.
Well, I like them for some. This is one. It's like I think that they serve a purpose, and I think that they are filling a need. And until physicians figure out a way to fill that need, they're going to continue to do. Or until doctors' offices do, they're super duper convenient, and they provide a level of access that many physicians' offices have not yet figured out how to do. And they're willing to use mid-level practitioners widely and broadly in a way that, again, many physicians are not wanting to be a part of. And because of that, they're filling an access need. And as long as they continue to do so, there are many, many, many acute, easy to take care of issues that they probably do a fairly good job of doing. The problem will be is if they start to get into, you know, leveling, you know, managing, you know, significant illness over the long term, they're not necessarily equipped to do that. But, you know, checking out a strep throat or an ear infection, I totally believe that they are more than capable of doing so. And it's much easier to do it there often than to go to the doctor's office.
Let's talk about Ebola for a second. Another American doctor that deals with it has apparently been diagnosed with it. But the UN has said we could see 20,000 Ebola cases. And yesterday we heard from the director for the CDC. Melanie, let's listen to Dr. Tom Friedman quickly at a news conference in Atlanta yesterday. Tom, Dr. Friedman says sealing off the borders is not the way to end the Ebola outbreak.
Give me one moment. I was
all right. Why don't you take a moment?
For all right. The promo,
take a few minutes.
Yeah, here we go.
Let us know what you're doing.
Yeah.
But about, well, forget the audio. Who gives a shit? Let me ask you, Aaron. You, when we brought this up a couple weeks ago, you said, "Hey, you know, it's not nearly as big of a deal as some in America. Certainly, it's not that much of a concern." Well, you tell me what you said.
So I said that, you know, Ebola is not one of those diseases that, you know, you could be carrying around for a long period of time before, you know, and making other people sick before you get it. That usually you are, by the time you're infectious, you're pretty symptomatic. It's also not, you know, totally airborne and easy to catch. So it's not one of those where there's, you know, runaway infection. And, you know, if you're sitting on a plane with someone or sitting in a room with someone, everybody on the plane is going to get it. And because of those two factors, it is not, you know, one of those that's going to spread like wildfire. It's not like flu or things that, you know, where it's like, because it doesn't kill you, tons of people are walking around outside with it and spreading it very easily, and therefore we have massive outbreaks all over the place. Ebola very quickly debilitates you, which either keeps you at home or puts you in the hospital, and it also doesn't really spread as easily, and it, by the time, again, you're infectious, everybody sort of knows and quarantine has taken effect. Therefore, in a highly resourced country that knows how to take care of people who are sick, that could get the word out, that could hospitalize and quarantine people very quickly and set up, you know, what is necessary in order to prevent transmission from one patient to the other. In highly resourced countries, you wouldn't see massive outbreaks. You would see small outbreaks possibly, but they would be pretty quickly contained, and it wouldn't be one of those where, like, oh my God, it's going to be all over the place tomorrow. The problem is that in low-resourced countries, they don't have the quarantining. They don't have, you know, the hospitals. They don't have a lot of the very basic things that we take for granted in terms of taking care of people, and so therefore these outbreaks continue to persist. They don't perhaps have the facilities to dispose of the bodies, and even the bodies, once people die, are pretty infectious in terms of, like, bodily fluids. So, you know, they linger, and they keep going, and when we talk about outbreaks, they're horrible, and they're in the numbers that, you know, get to the hundreds, but it's not millions, billions, you know, it's not like, you know, the movies that you're going to see on TV. They keep going, but they aren't going to reach sort of the panic endemic levels that we see, you know, in something that we really panic about, like Spanish flu or smallpox or something like that.
Let's listen quickly to Dr. Friedman, the head of the CDC. Just number three there, Melanie, just that one clip, because I think he generally agrees with what Dr. Carroll is saying in terms of a possible outbreak in the U.S. to put people's minds at ease. Go ahead.
We don't think Ebola would spread widely within the U.S. Routine healthcare infection control probably would prevent most transmission.
That's Dr. Tom Freeman, director of CDC from yesterday. So
I said it much longer than he did, but I was trying to explain why. But it's basically the same thing. It doesn't have the characteristics of the kind of sort of like end of the world, you know, diseases that we truly sometimes panic about. The ones where, you know, you could be infectious for a couple, you know, 2 weeks before anyone knows you have the illness. Right. And therefore it's spreading all over. We don't know who to quarantine. We don't know who might have it. We can't like shut down the world. But with Ebola, it's like, you're sick. Now you're contagious. Now we quarantine you. And it's very unlikely. You've been passing it around to tons of people. So we could pretty quickly round up the people who might have had it and just watch them. It's a, you know, a resourced country like the United States could probably contain it pretty quickly.
Let's go to Mark in Pennsylvania who's got a question for Dr. Carroll. 866-994-6343 if you want to be next. Go ahead, Mark.
Hi, Dr. Carroll. What's your opinion on the studies that have been done about GMOs? Everybody's all excited about that, and studies get quoted, but I just tell me what your opinion is on the quality of the studies that actually have been done.
You should watch my video on healthcare triage.
It's got a great video on YouTube, Mark, that you should watch, and if you like it, share it. But go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, so the gist of it is that, and again, I encourage you to go watch it because it's like 6 or 7 minutes long and it'll have like all the data you could possibly want. But the summary would be that, first of all, you know, you have to understand how genetic modification works. And, you know, for a long time, we have been trying to alter seeds. First, by trying to breed them. And then secondly, even back in the 1940s and 50s, they would irradiate seeds. And they still do in many places in the world, trying to get mutations and trying to get them to grow better or do things. So we've been fiddling with genes forever. So what you have to believe is somehow that, you know, we're fiddling with the genes in such a way that it's going to interfere. People's panic is that because they interfered with the genes in the plants, that somehow that's going to get into the DNA of humans. That's just not how it works. You know, when you eat stuff, it's DNA. You don't become a cow because you ate steak. Its DNA doesn't get into you. The DNAs don't mix for the most part. In fact, you know, absorbing DNA into your own DNA is not something that naturally occurs. There have been tons and tons and tons of studies, and even there's a website that I referenced that collects them all, like 1,800 studies that they could find and not, you know, in a period of a decade or more, that actually look at the safety and the quality and all this, and there's just no data that show that they are any more harmful than conventionally grown crops. And, you know, people often say, but all of it's done by industry. But it's like, you know, even when you eliminate all of the industry-sponsored studies, there are still hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of studies that have been done all over the world showing that the health outcomes or the dangers have just never been proven and are non-existent. And, again, I'm always you need to show harm and benefit. The benefits are known. It is so much easier to grow, you know, some of these crops, and you only need to look at many of the places in the third world where they talk about, you know, if we buy the seeds, we can actually grow way more crops on our land, and that's how we break out of poverty, and that's how we, you know, that's how Ethiopia moves forward. I just saw a great video on this that, you know, was part of the Gates Foundation recently. So there's, you know, it's not all evil. I understand people have environmental problems with it. I understand people are very upset at the way that some companies try to patent and monopolize this stuff, and they may have valid arguments. But from a health perspective, there's just no data and no evidence that show that there's any real long-time effects. And again, this is by looking at large studies in the aggregate. You're going to find someone who will find some study, find somewhere on the internet where it'll be small, and they will say, we fed it to rats, and then the rats got this. But when they do things in humans and they do them on a real scale with statistics and power, there's just no known effects. And again, it's one of those where people are, you know, eating this stuff all over the world at this point. It's like 50% of many of the products that are made in the United States have some sort of GMO in them. We're consuming this stuff every day. We're the healthiest we've ever been. And granted, obesity is a problem, and I own that, but don't blame that on the GMOs. But, you know, otherwise, in terms of many other diseases, we just keep living longer and being healthier. And so trying to continue to argue that somehow this stuff, as it becomes more ubiquitous, is more of a danger just doesn't match up to what...
What are your concerns, Mark, if any, about GMOs? I haven't looked at it nearly enough.
Go watch the video.
Yeah, and I've watched Aaron's video, but I'm not... I'm not as concerned, but what are your or others' concerns necessarily about outside what Aaron just said about the corporate behavior of monopolizing seeds and all that?
Well, Pete, I have a small sort of grass-fed dairy with their own little brand of yogurt and dairy products, and that's one of the big questions that people ask me. Do you feed your cows GMOs? Do you feed your cows GMOs? And I've been, I looked at myself, and I seem to, what it seems to be to me is this whole GMO issue is some sort of proxy for hating on big biotech companies like Monsanto. And, you know, it's hard for me to, if I want to feed, if me or other food producers want to say, hey, we make these food products that are GMO-free, that's actually, like you're suggesting, it's harder than it seems. It's quite a burden. So I kind of wish that if people want to hate on Monsanto, well, then hate on Monsanto. Don't make it difficult or even impossible for me to sort of assuage your paranoias.
Well, not only that, but if we keep pushing, like the problem is in Europe, they keep trying to drive everything to sort of, you know, have to have, you know, when we talk about labeling in the United States, one, that costs even the food companies money to do that, but secondly, it makes food more expensive. And given that there's a significant proportion of Americans who have trouble putting food on the table and rely on, you know, TANF and food stamps and things like that, and still, I see patients every day who don't know where the money's going to come for the next meal, and they can't afford food for their kids. Making food more expensive when there's no evidence for it rankles me. It's not something I like to hear about.
Mark, what is the? Do you want to mention the name of your company?
Wholesome Dairy Farms. We're like a small regional brand in southeast Pennsylvania, serving the Philadelphia area. And, you know, I'm really proud of the – this sounds like a plug. I'm really proud of the quality of our food and the way that we are the healthfulness of the cows and the way that we respect the environment and our practices. And, you know, if a whole bunch of studies came out and said, yeah, GMOs are poisonous to people, we still would be fine because the cows – are grass fed, and you know, I just feed them like meadow fescue, and that's what they eat. But you know, some things are kind of—it's really hard to trace back. Like I give my cows a little bit of byproduct, right? Like oats, okay? Just a taste, and you know, that means that I have to go back and to the feed mill and say, well, can you guarantee me these oats are GMO free? Well, no. Well, but if I want to buy GMO free oats.
Yeah.
Like Dr. Carroll said, that means I have to just pay a whole lot more for GMO-free guarantee when we all know that these oats, they've been, like you said, they're not wild oats anymore. They've been genetically modified, you know, some, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of years ago to have these big grain heads.
Well, don't get Dr. Carroll going on dairy, but let me ask you this. Dumb question, but I'm on your website right now, wholesomedairyfarms.com, Yellow House, Pennsylvania.
Where in Philadelphia are you?
I'm not in Philadelphia. I serve the Philadelphia area. We're in Berks County, about an hour outside of Philadelphia, close to Reading, Pennsylvania.
I like to support small companies like yours and Noble Pies and so on, Mark, so I'm happy to plug it. But you know, what I don't understand is why we don't feed – this is a dumb question, I think – all cattle grass versus corn, because I guess corn is a lot cheaper and there's a lot more of an abundance when you go corn. You can store it easier than grass. Is that the deal?
Well, yeah, dairy cows and beef cows, they're two different, well, animals, and you manage them differently, you feed them differently. Dairy cows metabolize just an incredible amount of energy, and corn is nutrient dense, it's energy dense. And it's like you said, it's an easy way. It's an economical way. Corn is plentiful. We can grow well in this climate, and that's the reason why.
Yeah, all right.
My grass fed dairy, I got about 100 acres, and I got about 50 cows. It would take a whole lot more land, really, to have all dairy cows be grass fed than to have them on these concentrated. On these capos, these animal.
I'll come by your farm at some point, Mark, and I'm glad you're listening. I appreciate the call. Thank you.
Bye.
I want to learn a lot more.
I just tweeted the GMO video for anyone that is interested.
I just tweeted the GMO video.
Well, we both did.
Well, there you go. Should get a lot more hits today.
Hopefully.
I want to talk about copays.
Did I tell you, by the way, Monsanto retweeted it?
No way.
Yeah.
Monsanto retweeted your defensive
discussion at the office. We're like, is that bad?
It's not bad. I mean,
oh,
you're
I know,
going
to, but yeah, they were like, yay.
You're going to burn in hell, but
yeah, and that's what I. That's literally what I said to them. I'm like, are we all burning in hell for this now?
So, it was funny at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Monsanto had a whole setup there.
Yeah.
And they had these great little drinks and all kinds
no
of fun stuff. And these kind of Mormon-like, happy white people going, hi, come on over to Monsanto. No, people went.
Yeah.
That's when Ideas, you know, it's kind of like the elite. I don't really, but I looked at it and I was like, man, they really should change their name. Just change the name.
Yeah.
That is bad. That is some damaged branding. But all right, I want to talk to you about the you wrote a piece about copays and how they add up. And I had a friend of mine reacted to it to support your opinion. And I want to talk about that. And I also want to talk about this marijuana study and issue, a couple of other things. We have a lot more with Dr. Aaron Carroll and your calls when we come back from our break. 866-994-6343. We'll be right back.
Stand up with Pete Dominic.
With Pete Dominic.
On SiriusXM Indy.
And welcome back to our conversation. Joining it, as he does almost every Wednesday, is Dr. Aaron Carroll. Give us a call with your questions about health, health insurance, health policy, or anything else. Always love to take your calls with Aaron. He's on Twitter at Aaron E. Carroll, two R's, two L's. The issue, I saw an article, Aaron, about marijuana. Let me try to find it here. Maybe helping people kick other painkillers that are more addictive.
News.
What's that?
Last week's Healthcare Triage News episode.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah.
Oh, my fault. I missed that. You were working so much and pumping out so many different pieces and videos. A new study found a drop in painkiller overdose deaths in 13 states that allowed medical marijuana.
So
now, talk about correlation and causation. There isn't any here.
No. There can be no. Here's what they did. It's a prospective cohort study, and while I talk to you, I'm actually going to post that on the blog. I'll post that on Twitter, too, so anyone can go watch that video. But so what they did with respect with theirs, that they looked at a bunch of states which did and did not have, you know, medical marijuana laws. And at the start of the study, I think there were, like, only three. I think it was, like, Washington, Oregon, and California. Of course, you know, what's up with the Pacific Coast? But regardless, they were the only three that had medical marijuana laws. And then over, like, a decade or so, other states added, and they could watch the number of overdose deaths or misuse deaths from prescription opioids for pain, for chronic pain, because, of course, that is one of the major reasons those drugs get prescribed, and they are, you know, many times abused or misused, or people die from overdoses. And what they found was that, you know, over the course of time, states that had medical marijuana laws had significantly lower rates of death from prescription opioid abuse or prescription opioid misuse than states without marijuana laws. And so, and this wasn't just, you know, a trend. They could do comparisons and see, you know, how quickly did the trends go down once they passed laws. Some states passed them at certain points over that time period because, as you said, and I think today it's like 24 states today have medical marijuana laws, which blew me away. I didn't actually realize it was that many. But almost half the states in the United States have passed medical marijuana laws at this point. And they found that, you know, over time and with all these other things, that there was a significant association between fewer deaths and medical marijuana. And they found that in 2010 alone, you know, the medical marijuana laws that have been passed appear to have been associated with 1,700 fewer deaths just that year from prescription opioid abuse or misuse. So we're talking significant numbers. Now, you know, all the usual caveats. It's not a randomized controlled trial. It's, you know, medical marijuana laws are different and regulations are different from state to state. Tons of other things can be going on. There's still no even, like, proof that, you know, medical marijuana law is a phenomenal drug for chronic pain. But it does appear that there's a significant association, and that over time, that there are these associations, and that there's the potential that medical marijuana law could be used in some cases to make things, you know, a bit safer for people who might have chronic pain and might be wanting to treat that.
Did you tweet that out?
I'm tweeting it out right now. I was talking, so I didn't want to do it.
No, well, usually you're doing 95 things at once.
I try, but I was paying more attention. But here, but I've
as
been
well as
right
as,
now, there
as
you
well
go.
As well as constructing a Lego Millennium Falcon.
No, not yet. But
hey, I gotta so. Ava, my 9-year-old, loves Legos, and they're just – I love getting them for her. But she puts them together, and she doesn't want to take them apart, and then they take up a lot of space, and I don't want to take them. Any advice?
Say it again. I'm sorry I missed half of that.
Any advice about what I should do with Ava's Legos? She's got all these different things built,
well,
and they start to take up space.
No, I mean, if she likes having them, let her have them. I mean, if
she likes having them and playing with them, but eventually I'm going to run out of space.
Well, that happened to us too. Jacob for a while was like obsessed with building these Star Wars Legos, and eventually they just all sort of went into the closet. But I mean, eventually you put them away, you put them in storage, or at some point you'll break them down. But I mean, I would do it and with her and talk to her about it. Don't just do it.
Can I? They're pretty expensive. Can I buy them used? Because you're missing one part.
But they're finding a used set where there are no missing pieces, and usually they're, like, pretty stingy. Like, you need every piece in the box. That's where it can get. Now, of course, if she's just free building, building just, you know, not following sort of the kit or anything else, then, of course, buy anything you like.
And then finally on the Legos, here's one right up your alley. A lot of times I did look on eBay and stuff, and it says all Legos all washed.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, you know, they can get pretty dirty, and you can imagine that, you know, little kids with their grubby hands are all over them all the time. So, I mean, I'm sure that's a concern for some people.
Is it a concern for you? Is there diseases?
No. I mean, now that you bring it up, it's just the kind of thing. If you wouldn't worry about, yeah, I probably would. I would probably just sort of, like, wash them in a bag or something, which is water. But, you know, I'd be worried about Ebola. You know, you just worry that, you know, the kid had the flu and was, you know, rubbing their fingers all over them or their snot.
Well, I'm not worried about that.
And don't worry.
Let me ask you about the one other issue. Well, a couple more. We got time. The copay thing you wrote was really pretty impactful, and you're referencing some other article I remember. But you know, you're basically saying next time somebody tells you that you know it's not that much money a copay, you know, read this, and then you know, even if someone isn't destitute, if they are you know doing okay, but they've got a child like a friend of mine with a chronic illness that you've got to go to see a doctor, you know, often. That adds up, and it's not always $20 a copay. It could be a lot more than that. So explain this because it's really, really important.
So there was a great – well, it wasn't great. It really upset and depressed me, but there was a very well-done piece in Time, like I think it was just last week, where a journalist was just talking about he had his car towed. And he went to the impound lot, and they're like, you know, it's a couple $100, pay it. And he said while he was there, it was just this, you know, nightmare scenario. Like, all of these people are, like, hanging out there. There were, like, families with little kids sleeping and people begging on the phone and people arguing, you know, if I don't get my car back, I'm going to lose my job. And, you know, I have to pick up my kids in an hour. What am I supposed to do? I can't reach them. And, you know, people were, like, you know, woman crying because, you know, she, you know, didn't have the hundreds of dollars that it was going to cost to get the car out, and she was going to lose her car, and therefore she was going to lose her livelihood. And, you know, of course, the journalist has the money, paid the fee, and got out of there. But he was talking about the fact that, you know, you don't sort of appreciate how, you know, close people are to the breaking point and how these little things really can set people over the edge. And I told the story about myself. I, you know, remember a couple years ago when we, you know, when I just started working, but we were still doing okay. You know, Amy's car needed new tires, and that they just told her. It was one of those, she's at the place, and they're like, your tires are so unsafe, we can't let you leave. You have to buy new tires right this second. And, you know, she was like, she called me in a panic. She's like, we don't have time to shop around. I want to make sure we get the best deal. I don't want to spend too much money. And I'm like, just buy the tires. What are we going to do? It's like a couple $100. You know, we're going to be okay. And I remember getting off the phone and thinking just like, my God, you know, this is an awesome place to be where I'm just assured that, you know, there's no way a couple $100 is going to break us. This, you know, this is really what sort of stability and safety, and I would even argue wealth, feels like. It's that level of comfort of like, you know, we're going to be fine. Nothing's going to happen. You know, we're able to sort of take what life throws at us. You know, these small minor things are going to be fine. It's not going to be a big deal. We really are doing okay. You realize not so many people are not like that. You know, couple $100 is all that, you know, separates them from, like, complete meltdown. And they live so close to the edge, and things are so tight that, you know, these little things that so many of us take for granted are nothing. And I got upset because in my world, this is the kind of stuff I hear every day, like $100 copay for going to the ER. Sure, that's fine. Who would not have a problem with that? Or, oh, you know, $25 premium for Medicaid. Why not? You know, every month, who doesn't have $25? Or, oh, you know, send people to get the morning after pill and over the counter, $50-$75. That's not, you know, these little things that all of us, a lot of us are like, oh, you know, that's a minor thing. People just have to make a decision between having cable or having that. You know, these are the kinds of things which so many of us take for granted, but for so many people, it's a real, real barrier. And putting up those kinds of barriers to people getting health care for acute things when they're sick, it's a real problem. And I think we sort of gloss over it all the time.
It really is, you know, I think you said it pretty well. I mean, I'm trying to move on to a couple more things. Ralph in Connecticut. And you should people can read that and share that post as well to Incidental Economist. Ralph, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the reason, I don't think you could scientifically prove it, maybe, but the reason why maybe they're seeing less of the opioid overdoses is when, you know, it's combined with the marijuana, it sort of makes it better, makes it nicer, rounds out the edges, and the people feel nice and satisfied, and they don't want to take any more pills. It's sort of like, you know, a little milk and sugar in the coffee makes it better. That's it.
It's possible. I don't know the answer. It is possible.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing with marijuana that for me, and that's why I'm such an advocate. I'm an advocate for its medicinal use. Beginning with, I'll never forget a guy who called into the program. It was years ago, and said that a buddy of his got burnt in Iraq, got burned, you know, over 70% of his body,
yeah.
And he tried everything, and nothing worked except for marijuana. But that was illegal for him, and I'll never forget that. I'm like, you know, and you hear that from people that have all kinds of nerve disorder with MS and other, when they've tried everything, but nothing else seems to work but this, Aaron. There's not maybe a study on that, but can we ever say anecdotally, hey, this is the only thing that I can take that makes the pain go away, or makes the anxiety go away, or helps me sleep? If someone takes five drugs and one works, can you anecdotally say, this is what I need, or is that in a?
It's very hard to do because, of course, you never know what is placebo effect or what is not. Of course, part of the problem is we have so little data on marijuana. See, first of all, go watch the video. I'll say it again. We have so little data on marijuana because there's so little study on it. But having said that, there was a little bit we covered in the video last week, which actually talked about that the federal government has a contract with I think it's University of Mississippi, and it's a solo contract to grow all the pot in the United States for use in research. And
right.
You know, in the past, it's an incredibly small amount, like, you know, 20, 30-some kilos. But this year, for the first time, they upped their order to 650 kilos of pot, which, first of all, as I said, awesome field trip. I would love to see where they grow that. But anyway, that means that they're upping the amount because they want to start letting people do much more research with it, which is, of course, awesome for science because now all of the unanswered questions about the safety and how we could use marijuana may finally get some focus. It may also signal that the federal government is considering maybe making medical marijuana legal, given that, you know, so many states are sort of doing it at this point. But regardless, the best thing we could do is start answering these questions that everybody keeps asking about. Can you do it? Does this work? Can you try that? We don't know. But that's because we've never had the marijuana to do the research, and it's hopefully likely in the very near future we will.
But you know, you say that, and I'm not sure that's necessarily true. I mean, I was reading this article the other day. It said the unfortunate truth is that there's nowhere close enough research on marijuana and its effect on humans to make definitive claims at this point. And that's because we're talking about that because it's Schedule One, and the government won't allow it. But isn't this too America-centric? Hasn't there been robust studies in Israel and England?
I don't know, to be honest about. Well, first of all,
caller said that earlier. He said, "Yeah, we don't have enough information based on the studies in America, but there have been like 30-year studies."
Trials, like randomized.
I don't know. I don't know.
That's what we need. We need those. I mean,
well,
honestly,
why would it be placebo? You said, okay, again, in my hypothetical, someone takes five drugs,
right,
and only one works, But isn't placebo mean one of them isn't the drug that they think they're taking? No.
If they run an N of one trial where they don't know which drug they're taking, and for like five successive months they use one after the other, and at the end we reveal which it is, and that's the one they go on, some evidence for that.
But why do you need that? Again, I'm just trying to understand. If I'm the patient and I know which drug I'm taking,
right,
and it's not working, and then one drug
does that because the placebo effect can wane over time. And if it is placebo, then what happens is you think it's
but it's not placebo. What am I missing here?
Pain control can be very much placebo. There have been phenomenal placebo trials where they show the placebo effect works, where they tell people
So you're saying
the pain goes away, but they really didn't give them morphine. You know, that happens. And so you can convince yourself, perhaps in the short term, that there is pain control. And if we're truly trying to manage someone's real pain, you know, I would rather know a drug works than to sort of guess.
The other thing, though, with marijuana, just stand up for one more moment, which is, you know, if I take a painkiller, an opioid painkiller, I mean, most of these prescription pharmaceutical painkillers are super addictive, and you can overdose on them.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Marijuana is not addictive. Not marijuana is not addictive that way, and you definitely can't overdose on it.
Correct. I'm not arguing, dude.
I know. I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't missing anything on that.
No. But the problem is that there's not a lot of proof that it's great for chronic pain. You know, we think maybe, we don't know. Wouldn't it be great to have a study which actually checked and saw if it did work? Because if it did, that would be obvious. Finally, we would be able to say, like, here's a proven use. Let's do this. No one would argue that would not be a good thing to convert people from, you know, I mean, I'm sure some people would argue, but I think most people would agree it would be better to convert people from, you know, chronic opioid prescription use to medical marijuana if we knew that it controlled pain.
Quickly, Jason in Boston.
I'm sorry to relay, Dr. Carroll, when your wife is at the tire shop and they tell her that her tires are so bad that they can't even let her leave and that you have to buy them right away. That's really just a scummy sales tactic.
I don't doubt that that is true, but we were naive and young and, you know, we just didn't know.
Jason, thank you for clearing that up.
There was a later time in my life when I suspected that was the case, but what are you going to do?
Isn't there like a penny test? I should have left them in there. You put a penny in there.
Truly, that was what it was. I mean, the stuff was bare. I'm not arguing because I'd seen the tires and it was bare, but I'm sure she would have been fine.
Thank you so much for joining us today, man. Really great stuff as always. If you didn't learn anything, then you weren't listening well enough. And you should be following Dr. Carroll on Twitter because he'll tweet out all the links to his videos and his blogs and his articles at Aaron E. Carroll. Follow him there. Aaron, I'm looking at my Twitter numbers here. 19,997. Today's the day.
Ooh, look at you.
Today's the big day. And Aaron Carroll, I fear, will surpass me at some point soon. 13,326. Let's get him up there to 13.5. Is that possible? The replay?
Do it.
Follow Aaron. Be a patriotic American. At Aaron E. Carroll. Thanks, Aaron.